Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your hosts for this weekend show. This weekend show is going to be focused more big picture, economics and markets in terms of what the longer term repercussions of this war in the Middle East could be on economic data and markets. And I also want to get into this whole topic of private credit. All I hear is private credit is the next bomb to take down the markets. Look, if you want more of the metals commentary, we did a lot of that throughout the week. But quite frankly, these markets are, in a way, schizophrenic. It's hard to even know what direction they're moving day to day because we are still so much living off of tweets, news articles, and Trump's speech on Wednesday night. That caused a lot of volatility as well. So let's get into this show. Starting off with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at OnePoint BFG Wealth Partners and editor of the Book Report on Substack. I'll post that Substack article in the show notes on our website, podcast, and YouTube channel. Peter, thanks for taking time with us on this weekend show. I want to talk about what you see as some of the longer term repercussions or maybe some of the sticky economic functions that we will see coming out the back of this war, whenever it ends. What's your outlook here?
Well, I think it's a question of where commodity prices settle out at after the war, particularly obviously crude oil and where natural gas prices and LNG prices in Europe and Asia fall back to. Take crude oil, for example, we were sitting around $65 prior to the war, which I thought at the time was dirt cheap. I don't think we go back to $65 so quickly. I think 85 is going to be the new 65. I think that we have to understand that a lot of facilities have been damaged. It's going to take time to bring them online. I think one of the big picture factors to why I was bullish prior to the war was U.S. shale, which has seen a major production slowdown where we may have seen for now a plateau in U.S. oil production. I do think you're going to have strategic reserves built up everywhere around the world, both at the corporate level and the country level, and everyone's going to stockpile as many commodities as they possibly can so they don't get short with another geopolitical event that leaves them scrambling for product. So I think a few of these reasons is why we're going to have a higher low, I guess you can say, from a chart pattern when it comes to crude. Now, other commodities, I mean, it's really been for particularly nitrogen in particular with that fertilizer, where more than a third of the world's urea is sourced in the Middle East. So maybe there'll be stockpiling of that. So I think it'll just drag on the persistency of inflation. You know, one interesting thing with inflation is if you look at the February data in the U.S. prior to the war, like PPI, import prices, they all were really hot even before the war started. So, you know, there's this belief of some that if price pressures don't show up in consumer price inflation, therefore there's no inflation. But inflation, cost pressures don't just disappear. It's just in a different part of the supply chain. So it ties the hands of the Fed and other central banks, and it keeps interest rates elevated. Now, there will be other things that hopefully normalize. I mean, ships going through again will restock and so on, and the world will get back to some normality. I just think it's going to be a bit different than where it was prior to the war. And a lot still depends, too, on the state of the Iranian regime. And they have a desire to charge tolls for ships going through the strait. So it's hard to think that we're going to go back to the way we were.
Yeah, Peter, I think it's a great point. I don't think oil prices are going to be going back down to the pre-war levels. But to the point you made about fertilizers, it's not just an energy story. And the fact that hydrocarbons go into so many different products, from plastics to fertilizers and everything else, but there was a lot of fertilizer being shipped through the Strait of Hormuz. Also, a lot of helium, which goes into the chips. So there's a lot of knock-on effects here as far as what it does to inflation. To the point you just made about inflation, if it continues to tick higher, what does that do to central bank policy when they've talked? Everybody was coming into this year expecting a lot of cuts, just like last year, they're expecting more cuts than we got. But there's a lot of central banks now considering rate hikes. So what does this shift in monetary policy potentially mean due to all this high inflation?
Well, I think the hikes that are talked about, even from some of the central bankers, particularly in Europe, I think it's dangerous to respond to an energy shock with rates, because raising rates doesn't get you more oil out of the ground. And in fact, it just raises the cost of capital for those that try to get it out of the ground. On the flip side, the economic damage that's done by an energy shock, I don't think central banks should respond to that either with rate cuts. I think that the central bankers around the world are pretty much in spectator mode. They're sitting back and waiting to see how this plays out, because we have no choice. When I say we, the world has no choice but to have it fully reopen within the next couple of weeks, because you're going to have, and you're beginning to have already, COVID-like shutdowns in a variety of different things. And that's just, if you want to keep craziness in the streets, then you need to fully reopen this. And I think, look at the day we're taping this, the S&P 500, was down 100 points this morning. Now it's only down 18, because there was a story about Iran and Oman trying to figure out some protocol for sending ships through. And then there was another story about 40 different countries trying to form a coalition to reopen the strait, because the world has no choice but to have the strait reopen, and they're not going to allow Iran to have a vice grip on it.
Yeah, and Iran has shown that it seems like they can shut down the strait or at least scare people from shipping any oil across it. It's just a crazy world right now where the markets are extremely volatile and doesn't seem like really investors know which direction to go day after day. On that higher oil price narrative, I know you were really on that bandwagon before this war started. And as the price has spiked, one thing I find curious is that in the US, I realize this war is still pretty new, but we haven't seen rig counts move higher. Is that telling you anything about what the oil companies are doing or potentially even the sustained rally these oil stocks could have?
Well, I think oil companies, and you're right, the rig count has been strangely little changed since the war began. I think oil executives are looking out at the futures curve. Now, I want to be clear, the futures curve is predictive for the day of you're looking at it. The world can change tomorrow. So I don't look at the futures curve as necessarily predictive, but I do think oil executives are looking. I mean, I'm looking at the curve out to even next year, but looking out to December this year. WTI is trading at that December contract's trading at $71. So the front month is trading at 111. That's quite a gap. But an oil executive is not going to ramp up production necessarily for something long-lived when the December contract's trading at 71. If all of a sudden executives are realizing that we're in a higher priced environment, and if I'm right that 85 is the new 65, and that's something more sustainable, well then, yeah, you'll see an increase in supply that maybe can then temper that increase to 85. But the market doesn't believe that these prices are sustainable, at least today, as I said. And I think everyone is really waiting to react only after the war ends, the strait reopens.
Peter, I don't want to be a pessimist, but let's just say that the war doesn't end and the strait still has challenges. Some people have made the point that every day this goes on, we're kind of going to take a week or so to repair the damage. And so if it goes on for weeks, we could be looking at months of damage. If that moves the forward curve up a little bit more on the futures and oil companies could lock in something like the 80s or even the 90s eventually, would you want to see companies start hedging? Would you want to see people that are at oil companies start grabbing onto the long range prices and lock those in? Or would you rather keep them more available for even potential more upside? Because there are still some oil analysts expecting triple digit oil to stay around and possibly test the all-time highs at 140. So in a pessimistic scenario, would you like to see more hedging? What's your outlook there as far as energy companies?
I mean, I would say you would want to see a mix, and that's under any price and macro environment. When you have a big move, lock in some hedges on those prices and have some unexposed. Because also from an investor perspective, investors want to own oil stocks as a play on the price of oil. And when they think oil prices are going to go down, they sell their oil stocks. If oil companies start to hedge out all of their exposure, then that becomes sort of a different investment vehicle from the investor perspective. So I would say something in between.
So, broad picture for these markets. Look, markets were arguably starting to correct before this war, especially those high-flying tech stocks. Those were getting hit pretty hard before the war on fears that AI would take away a lot of the software that companies and people use. All kinds of different reasons. Even that maybe we'd start to see less CapEx out of some of these hyperscalers. Where are some market dislocations in some of the big stocks or bigger sectors that you see, or are there any dislocations right now?
Well, I do think that this was a big trend change late 2025 into early 2026 was the waning momentum of the Gen AI tech trade, particularly the hyperscalers. And I think that's because investors started to re-rate the multiples on these companies because of their deteriorating cash flows, because of all the money that they're spending building out this infrastructure. And even from a competitive standpoint, NVIDIA, which is a huge beneficiary of all that spend, is reporting, blowout quarter after blowout quarter. The stock is no higher than it was last August. And I think that's because investors are questioning whether a 75% gross margin is sustainable with the growing competition, whether it's Google's TPUs that Broadcom is making, or Amazon's Trainium chips, or something else. Or the threat that maybe the hyperscalers will at some point slow down the pace of their spend. Regardless, I think we're losing the leadership of this spectacular group that has been unbelievable in terms of market performance. So that was a big thing even before the war.
Well, Peter, a lot of people believe that if we see the AI data center spend and CapEx come down, and some people believe that it's peaked this year, and if you look forward, if some of this infrastructure doesn't get built, could that mean we are starting to see a slowdown in the economy? Well, how does that affect things like copper? How does that affect the commodities or the energy requirements that we may need if maybe things got a little overdone on the CapEx spend side, and we don't see some of the build out that many people were expecting.
Yeah, that's an interesting question that I think about as well. I think if you look at 2025, at least in the US, I've seen statistics as 40 to 45% of GDP growth was due to data center construction. I do think that we are most likely building too many data centers in terms of the space that's needed because computing power or hardware gets smaller over time, but gets more powerful. So maybe we don't need as much space. But maybe the existing facilities, because the computing needs continue to rise, that more usage and more and lower token prices, for example, with these AI models will drive even more need for energy to power it. So that's where I sort of go back and forth on. In terms of the physical facilities, you mentioned copper. Yeah, I mean, always with industrial metals, we always have to understand the cyclicality of it. I think the biggest driver of copper has certainly been China, and that demand has waned with what's gone on in their property market. And of course, the world is trying to find other uses of copper to offset that weakness, and it has. But I do think that we have to be sensitive to the trends in this data center construction because if it falters, if it slows, well, it's as I said, it's going to have a direct impact on the U.S. economy, and could have a big impact on the U.S. stock market because of the heavy concentration, of course, in all these infrastructure AI builders.
I really do think this is one thing that has investors uneasy, and I even think the government understands this, is that all that spending going into these data centers, if it goes away, the economic numbers completely reverse, actually.
Well, it's interesting you say that because it depends on what government. State governments, the state of Maine came out and said, we don't want any new data centers, because they're all worried about the price to electricity and so on. So We need more, which is a strange thing because hopefully people can figure out the electricity part of it. But to say I don't want that building in my state is quite a backward seeming thing, because I do believe that we'll build enough energy capacity to manage all this to temper the price increases. So it's an interesting tug of war.
It is, and it's still very much a moving target. I do want to move on to what I said on the intro about this other maybe bomb in the wings that so many people are talking about, private credit. Can you just take our listeners through what the situation is with private credit and why everyone seems so worried about it, please?
So private credit being a sort of relatively new asset class. Now, business development companies have been around for a while, just as another form of financing LBOs, private equity LBOs. That was really why they started. And then after the banks sort of slowed down the pace of their lending because of the regulatory constraints post GFC, enormous amounts of money piled in to the private credit space, and it became your classic too much money chasing not enough good loans. And then private credit said, hey, this is a great business. Let's tap into as much money as we can outside of our traditional investors, being endowments, pension funds, insurance companies, even some family offices. And like, let's go into retail. Let's democratize private credit, which on paper sounds fine. Let's open up investment opportunities to everyone. The problem has become that liquidity needs and time horizons of private equity, private credit don't always align with retail. Now, there's some retail high net worth individuals that can say, hey, here's my check. Give me back my money over the next 10 years in terms of interest income, and I'll get my principal back at the end of that road or at some future time. But a lot of retail might say they are fine with the liquidity constraints and time horizons, but when things hit the fan, they're really not. And it just, to me, was always an unhealthy relationship. And now it's coming home to roost, because not only do you have rising default rates, and that's not my opinion, Fitch said it a few, let's said it last month. And ironically, there was little defaults in software. It was mostly in healthcare providers and consumer product companies. But now you also have retail that wants some of their money back. So how do you manage a fund when you're getting inflows in one door and you're getting redemptions out the other door? And that can't be easy. And then when this flips, where there's more money going out than coming in, then it really becomes a bigger issue. And then, of course, this is an asset class that has not been stress tested in a recession, because this really blossomed post GFC. So that'll be the real next test, is how it does in an economic downturn. And I think to bottom line it, the net result is a rising cost of capital for a lot of small, medium-sized businesses.
Well, Peter, just to that point, it seems like a lot of businesses were trying to skirt the public financing aspects and go private because of some of it was the reaction to the Dodd-Frank Act, as what some people have mentioned, but also it just seems like private credit had more of an increased attraction because, to your point, it is a little bit less regulated. There is less oversight, but it hasn't been stress tested against a recession yet. With all these redemptions coming in and some of these funds literally filing for bankruptcy, is there going to be a rotation out of private credit and back into public credit? Was there a shunning of public credit for some other reason that you see?
No, I think banks are going to try to grab back market share, particularly after the changes in Basel III and what the Fed has loosened up with the regulatory capital needs for the banks. So I think some of this lending is going to go back to the conventional banks.
So does that mean banks are a buy here?
I mean, it's just where sort of that market share will go. Obviously it'll depend on the underwriting skills of those loan officers. But I do think that the earnings power of banks will increase with the greater ability for them to do what they used to do, and that was take in deposits and give out loans.
Well, Peter, just add another wrinkle to all of this. In addition to public debt and private debt, there's also our credit. There's also the aspect that, and you just were writing about this today on your Substack, that There's a lot of foreign investment capital that has US assets that may be pulling in those assets, which is strengthening the dollar to some degree because they need capital converted back over to their own currency, or they're shedding some of their US assets. What do you think the effect of foreign investment capital into bonds, equities, what kind of effect could an outflow from foreign capital be on these markets?
So just to quantify, the government, U.S. government updated these numbers just, I think it was on Monday or last, or the prior Monday, where they gave the fourth quarter 2025 net investment position for the U.S. In other words, quantifying how much of assets do foreigners own in the U.S. and how much of foreign assets do U.S. investors own. And that net capital position was a minus 27 and a half trillion dollars. In other words, foreigners owned 27 and a half trillion dollars more of US assets that we owned of their assets. Now, of course, we're a big market, so that's one of the factors, but between the US Treasury market and the US stock market, particularly big cap tech stocks, foreigners own a chunk of these markets. So when you see what has gone on in March, when a bunch of countries basically need the money to either procure oil at much higher prices or subsidize their consumers and to mitigate the increase in bills that they're now going to have, there's probably no doubt that we saw selling of US assets. And particularly with the US Treasury market, where foreigners own about 30% of the market, if you slice out the central banks and the government, so call it to what's called the official holdings of foreign capital in the US Treasury market, that those holdings are down to the lowest since 2012. And I do think that that picked up pace when we slapped on, we started a tariff war with the rest of the world. Now, that pace has been slowing for 10 years. I don't want to think that this is a brand new thing. Foreigners have re been reducing their holdings of US assets. But I do think that it picked up pace a year ago in the treasury market, not so much in the stock market, but I do think that foreigners really ramped up their hedging of their dollar exposure along with their ownership of US stocks.
It was noteworthy last year, too, that the US market out of the developed markets was one of the worst performers. And then you can even tack on the decline in the dollar, too. Peter, is this just all leading to the end of US market dominance? Or is that just taking this all a step too far and this is all part of a natural market cycle?
I think it's more of just a rethink of the overexposure that foreigners had to the US market. Now, we can understand it. I mean, US technology companies have just been so unbelievable over the past 15 years that it sucked in capital from around the world. No one was like what Apple has done and Meta and Google and Microsoft and Amazon. I mean, what spectacular companies. And when you compare that to, other markets like the UK and others in Europe, where it's more old economy industrials and energy and financials and so on, you can understand why a lot of money piled into the US. But I think maybe the pendulum swung too much in one direction. And investors are now saying, okay, well, maybe we have too much allocated. And you look at, it's no coincidence that as the holdings of treasuries, for example, has shrunk, particularly since 2022, the price of gold has gone up because a lot of central banks are saying, well, I'd rather own gold if I'm going to diversify out of US dollars and US treasuries. So that there's a very tight connection as well in terms of that reserve diversification.
Well, Peter, another topic that's being thrown a lot in the financial media, I'd love to get you to weigh in on it, is in light of the potentially stickier inflation or even rising inflation, in light of the fact that some of the job layoffs have been a result of AI and in result of the higher energy prices and just that kind of environment, a lot of people are alluding to the 1970s environment and throwing around the word stagflation again. Now, there's a lot of people on either side of this debate, but where do you stand? Is this all becoming stagflationary? Can this slow down the growth? We've seen it in GDP growth. How are you looking at the particular environment as it relates to an analog to the 1970s?
Well, I think if the strait reopens within days or weeks, we'll be able to manage this shock. There's no doubt there it's a shock, and there'll be over the next couple of months and or next couple of quarters economic consequences to it. But I do believe that the world's going to quickly adjust once it reopens. You know, I think growth even before this was just modest. You know, U.S. growth last year was 2%. European growth is maybe 1%. So it's not like major parts of the world were set up to absorb shocks like this. So the stagflationary situation, yeah, it's real, where you're going to have persistent inflation and modest growth. And it's not necessarily like the 1970s in terms of the extent, but it is a form of it. And it further complicates the jobs of central bankers. I mean, central bankers had license to do whatever they wanted when inflation was very low. And now they no longer have that license. Now there are a lot of trade-offs. And it's just a much trickier, more friction-led situation than people are used to over many years. So while not a full replay of the 1970s, you know, maybe a sequel of some sort to the 1970s. And you can be sure a lot of portfolios are still set up for this era of declining interest rates, low inflation, buy tech, everything's fine. Things are changing. They started changing last year with the outperformance of metals and international markets. And it's certainly changing this year for sure.
So, Peter, you mentioned metals there in terms of precious metals. You know much how our audience likes to focus on those. Look, they had a heck of a run last year. This year it's been choppy and a horrible month of March, but they have been on a bit of a rebound here. Some short-term chart damage done, loss of momentum, but also longer-term charts. We're saying that it was due for some sort of a pullback. Where do you see precious metals, especially gold, situated?
Yeah, I mean, it does come in that context of what was almost it was a parabolic move in silver, less so in gold. But after that run-up, it was due for a correction. It was due for a period of consolidation and digestion, and this was pre-war. Then, of course, you throw in the war, and you had this, you know, global short dollar buy non-dollar assets that unwound, and gold certainly a non-dollar asset, even though it's sort of a non-fiat currency asset, but you know what I'm talking about with the dollar. And then, of course, the rise in real rates. And then now there's talk about gold being a source of funds for countries that need the money. You know, we talked about tapping U.S. stocks and treasuries for money. Well, Turkey did a gold swap to bring in dollars to defend the lira. There was chatter that Poland was going to sell some of their gold holdings to finance an increase in defense spending. India's put some new rules in. They're not selling gold, but they put in some new rules in trying to defend the rupee weakness. So that's still a possibility. I mean, gold is owned for a rainy day, and it's certainly raining out there. So I don't want to discount the possibility that we could see further selling of gold. That said, when the dust settles, it's still, I think it has established itself as the most important reserve asset. And one of the big trends maybe going forward, because of the strong dollar and other countries trying to defend the weakness in their currencies, is they're asking again, why are we so dependent on the US dollar? You know, 75% of the world's GDP takes place outside the US. And I do think that this is just going to accelerate the trend that we saw before the war, where more and more countries were transacting in their own currencies and not in US dollars, particularly when it came to crude oil and commodities, particularly when it came to China trading with the rest of the world as well. So I think that desire to trade in things other than the dollar is only going to pick up pace, and gold can be sort of that settlement currency for balance of payments.
It does seem like the world has continued in a way to move that direction, especially over the last couple of years. Peter, I really appreciate you trying to predict the future here. That's really what we're looking forward to. We're trying to make educated guesses on what this war fallout is and what some of the risks are to these markets. But I always like to ask, and I think it's most important, to see what you're doing with your portfolio. We don't need specific names unless you want to share them, but what sort of a posture, what trends are you playing in your portfolio?
Well, I mentioned we were bullish and long energy stocks going into this. I'm trying to figure out what to do with them now in light of the big move. We trimmed slightly, but I've become more bullish on U.S. natural gas stocks. Natural gas prices in the U.S. have remained, you know, very depressed, relatively speaking, to what's going on in the rest of the world. And you know, I think US LNG exports and Canadian LNG exports just become ever more important as more and more countries want to rely on other trading partners for it. So we've added a bit to that, trimmed some of the other oil stocks, actually one oil stock, still pretty bullish generally on commodities, ag in particular, fertilizer. You know, we sold almost all of our silver in late 2025, early 2026, and trying to figure, you know, in that parabolic move and trying to figure out a time to get back in. International really haven't changed much there. I still own a bunch of cheap stocks there that, irrespective of their high exposure to energy imports, I still think that these companies will do just fine. And, you know, there's a lot of stocks that have just been thrown out the window here that I think are pretty cheap. So I haven't really changed too much, to be honest, post-war. You know, again, I didn't buy the energy stocks because I was betting on a war. That's the last thing I was thinking about. But I do think that the commodities and hard assets are important to own in this kind of environment.
All right, we'll wrap it up here. Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at OnePoint BFG Wealth Partners and editor of the book report on Substack. Click that link in the show notes to follow along with Peter. We both get all Peter's stuff through Substack, and every day it's a very valuable source of really giving us the lay of the land of what's happening in the world, in the economic data, and with markets and earnings. So, Peter, great having you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. And everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back.
Thank you, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.